Good morning, everyone. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be here in the sunshine. We've had a lot of rain in Vancouver. And it's so lovely to sit with all of you, practice with all of you. Our teacher, Norman Fisher, over the years has always said, oh, it's so great to come and just sit with and practice with you and not have to organize anything. And now I know what he meant. And be taken care of so beautifully, fed and housed. And yeah, feels very sweet. So, it was very dry here. I really have to keep hydrated, I notice. So today, I thought I'd tell you another old Zen story. Yesterday, Michael told you about finding the one who's not busy. And today I'm going to talk about finding the one who's not ill. I've been digging into this one for several months now because I find that I seem to know an awful lot of people these days who are ill or know about or be told about people who are ill. Some of them very ill. I and many of my age cohort have parents in more or less advanced old age who are ill and frail and coping well or not so well with the gradual breakdown of the aging body and mind. It's not always easy to witness and support with care and skill that process. And I can't help but wonder how would I handle not being able to be busy? Not being able to cook, not being able to go for a walk. This is my mom. She's 93. She's always cooked for, you know, always cooked for herself, and not to be able to is a bitter pill to swallow. I've said to her, Mom, I'm with you. I'd find that really hard too. Not to be able to go for a walk, not to be able to hear the bird songs that gave her such joy all her life. Not to have the mental acuity to enjoy reading a book. How would that be? You know, for those of us who are book lovers, reading being a great source of nourishment, not being able to do that anymore. Or how would I handle chronic pain or bowels that don't perform reliably or hands that tremble? I ask myself these questions. Could I accept those changes with some measure of grace and good humor? Without bitterness? Not all the people I know who are ill or hear about are elderly. Some are my own age. Some are even younger. I myself have been blessed with extraordinary good health for the most part, so it was kind of fitting that I would catch a minor cold just before coming here and find the one who is not ill, have to, you know, practice that myself. It's very easy for those of us who have good health to take for granted the reliable functioning of body and mind. So often we have to run smack into a big impediment before we face the realities of sickness, old age, and death. The Buddha himself was a young man who had lived a protected and privileged existence before he was drawn to explore life outside his father's palace walls. And there he saw for the first time a sick man covered with sores, an aged old woman withered and frail, and a corpse lying by the roadside. These were the three messengers. That's what they were called, the three messengers who first taught young Siddhartha Gautama the reality of impermanence in human life. Some of us are introduced to one or more of the three messengers early in life, but others of us are well into adulthood before we meet them. Comes as a shock. In our culture where we don't have corpses lying by the roadside. Other parts of the world do, as we know. The fourth messenger young Siddhartha met that day was a sage sitting in meditation. It struck him that perhaps the sage could teach him how to live in a world where we must suffer pain and debility and ultimately must part with everything we hold dear. Many of us come to practice similarly motivated. We want to find out how to be free from fear and anxiety, from the anguish of getting what we don't want in life and not getting what we do want. So those three messengers, sickness, old age, and death, also stand in for the many other kinds of affliction that we suffer from. All the smaller losses, deprivations, injuries, and what have been called the bourgeois sufferings. You know, the parking tickets, the broken cell phones that we suffer from as well. So these three messengers stand for all those great and small sufferings. So keeping that in mind, let's see what some of our old Chinese Zen ancestors had to say about facing illness, old age, and death. This is a koan, like the one yesterday from the Book of Serenity, which is a collection of 100 koans from ancient China. And it's a dialogue between Dongshan and an unnamed monk. Dongshan was the founder in China of our particular school of Zen. Caodong in Chinese becomes Soto in Japanese. So Dongshan was ill. And the monk came in as Dongshan was lying down and said, "You are ill, teacher. But is there anyone who does not get ill?" "Yes, there is," said Dongshan. The monk asked, "Does the one who is not ill take care of you?" And Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to take care of him." "How is it when you take care of him?" the monk asked. Dongshan said, "At that time, I don't see the sickness." So this koan reminds me of the words of Stephen Levine. You know who he is? He's taught and wrote many books for decades in the area of death and dying. And until his own death just this past January. And I could not find, there's a particular quote, and I have not been able to find it, but I'm almost positive it's from him. And it goes something like this. When you sit with someone who is dying day after day, breathing in and out together, after a while you're not sure anymore who is ill and who is healthy, who is dying and who is the caregiver. In my work life, I used to train hospice volunteers. And before that, I was a hospice volunteer myself. And people often ask hospice volunteers or staff, often hear people say, "Oh, I don't know how you do that. I couldn't do that. Isn't that just too sad? Isn't that just too hard?" And hospice volunteers or staff often reply, well, actually, I find that I receive more than I give. And I find that even in the midst of that suffering and sadness, there are such moments of warmth and humor and joy and courage that I feel nourished in doing this work. When we train hospice volunteers, we emphasize cultivating an open and compassionate presence, not a doing presence, but a being presence. A capacity to see the individual who is sick or dying as a whole person, a person who has memories, abilities, a person who had led a complete life. And the person being seen in that way, not just as a sick person, as a person with cancer, responds, often responds, not always, but often responds with trust and openness. Sometimes to a degree that they may never have felt in their whole life before. I've seen that. And a volunteer or anyone who steps into that role of serving others often has their own doubts and fears about their own adequacy to do that work of care that they've undertaken. And in being received by that person, they are themselves healed. So in a sense, they are taken care of by the one who is not sick in the sick person. Yeah. In our meal chant, I wasn't here for the meal chant yesterday, so I'm not sure if you chanted the line that goes, may we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. You might have done the shorter version, but yeah. So that's my just favorite line. may we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And by emptiness, we don't mean, you know, void or anything like that. What we mean is the non-separateness, the non-separation of giver, receiver, and gift. Which we can really feel in formal Zen meals when we are serving and receiving others. It's a practice of giving, receiving, of the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift to serve and receive food. And eat it. So in these koan collections, there's the koan and then there's a commentary. Some of the commentary is much longer than the koan, typically. The commentaries are by someone else other than the person who originally collected the koans, usually. So this koan has quite a long commentary. It's by Wan Song. And there's a little introduction, typically. In the introduction, he says, when the physical elements are out of tune, how does one attend and nurture? When you are ill, is there a not ill person who cares for you? Is there a way that being ill gives you an opportunity to care for the one who cares for you? When you are ill, is there also one who is not ill in you? Who cares for whom? In Buddhist teaching, delusion, self-clinging, is referred to as illness, and the Buddha as the great physician, and the practice as the medicine. And is any of us free from that delusion of self-clinging? I'm not. Once in a while, a little, maybe. We have to be honest with ourselves and ask, what story of limitation, of impairment, is part of my inner habitual narrative that I cling to, perhaps to explain my life or out of fear of letting it go? It might be my older sister was always the smarter, more talented, prettier one. Or it might be my abusive alcoholic father ruined my life. We each have a story or stories. It's not that we need to deny those stories or suppress them, but we need to recognize that they're always partial, that they're always conditioned. They arise within a matrix of causes and conditions far beyond this little life, and that they're always subject to change. So we don't need to hang on to them. And we don't need to let them define us. Wansung, the commentator, says, this is where everyday practice empowers you when you're not, when you're dying. It says, everyday practice empowers you when you're dying. Or we could add, when you're dealing with sickness or aging or affliction of any kind. Within each of us is one who is sick, wounded, lonely, suffering, and one who is not sick, not suffering, not cut off from others. When the monk asks Dongshan, is there one who is not sick? He's saying, are you more than a sick old man? And Dongshan says emphatically, yes. And not only that, it is with my whole being that I can look after this weak, ill body right now. And it's with my whole being that I'm here present with you. How does he do that? When he says, I don't see that there is an illness, I don't think he's in denial, simply that he's not identifying with the illness, or wasting energy lamenting his fate, or being frustrated that he can't do all the things he usually does. He just attends and nurtures. Attends and nurtures, responds to what the body, mind, and heart need. So there's another koan. There's always another koan that's relevant here. And this one's from the Blue Cliff Record, which is another collection. And this one's not a story. It's just a short quote from Zen Master Yunmen. And it goes, medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? What do you think he means? These koans sound so cryptic and impossible. Isn't the purpose of medicine to subdue disease? But, of course, medicine is not always successful, is it? Sometimes the disease is too powerful. The chemotherapy fails. The infection resists the antibiotic. The antidepressant does more harm than good. But maybe the meaning here goes beyond the battle metaphor of disease, of medicine as weapon against disease. Maybe it's that medicine and disease are two sides of a single coin, like life and death, light and darkness, enlightenment and delusion. In Buddhism, we talk about the relative and the absolute. The relative, the particularity of our lives. The absolute, the unity of our lives with everything. Simultaneous and mutually necessary truths, rather than oppositional. And if we were too attached to one, and too aversive to the other, we suffer. In the commentary on this koan, Yuan Wu, the commentator, tells another story. There's always stories within stories within stories in these things. This story is about Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and his disciple Sudana. So one day Manjushri asked Sudana to go out and gather some medicinal herbs. And he said, if there is something that is not medicine, bring it to me. So Sudhana went out in the fields and forests. He couldn't find anything that was not medicine. So he came back and said, there is nothing that is not medicine. So Manjushri said, okay, so go out and gather something that is medicine and bring it to me. So Sudhana picked a blade of grass and gave it to Manjushri. And then Manjushri held it up to the assembly and said, this medicine can kill people and it can also bring people to life. So as you know, there are such substances in the plant world, right, that can heal or kill depending on the dosage and how and the method of preparation. But also, each experience in our life can kill us or bring us to life depending on how we meet it. Right? A parking ticket, a hike in the mountains, a marriage, a cancer. Can kill us or bring us to life. Each moment can kill us or bring us to life. Right here, sitting in Sesshin, you've probably died and been brought to life several times already. If the whole earth is medicine, then even poison can be transformed into nourishment. I don't know if you've done some reading in Norman Fisher's book on the Tibetan Lojong teachings. One of those Lojong teachings is turn all adverse circumstances into the path. That's what that is. That's transforming poison into medicine, to nourishment. How do we meet circumstances that thwart and limit us? As illness, accident, the vicissitudes of life inevitably will. How do we find the one who is not ill, not hurt, old, impaired in one way or another? Let's go back to the first koan again. In the commentary, Wansong tells a couple more stories about two old Zen masters and how they met their own death. First one's our friend Dongshan. So when Dongshan realized he was nearing death, he asked one of his monks, when I leave this leaking husk, where will you go to meet me? The monk was stumped. He couldn't answer. So Dongshan composed a verse. So that's what you did in those days in Tang China. He composed a verse. And his verse was, though students are many, not one is awakened. The mistake lies in pursuing the path of others' tongues. If you want to be able to let go of the body and leave no trace, practice diligently to walk in emptiness. So he's saying, don't cling. Not to your body, not to your teacher, not to the teachings themselves. True reality is vast beyond words. After reciting the verse, he shaved his head, sat in zazen, rang a bell, said farewell to the assembly, and appeared to die right there. The monks wailed in grief. Dongshan opened his eyes and asked for a meal for stupidity to be prepared. That's what it says. He extended his life for 7 more days so people could be a little better prepared. Again, bade everyone farewell, sat in zazen, and died. This story echoes the very beautiful and moving story of the Buddha's own death. The Buddha delayed his death, the legend goes, 2 or 3 months, and was very, very careful about preparing the Sangha to go on without him. Gave very detailed instructions, attended to his faithful, long-time attendant, Ananda, and his grief. It's a beautiful story, and we tell it every year on the anniversary of the Buddha's death. The second story concerns Master Fa Jing, whose attendant was reading the record of Dongshan and came to the story of Dongshan's death. "That man of old was quite extraordinary," Fa Jing commented. The attendant said that. And then Fa Jing replied, "After I die, you can call on me. If I can return, this will be because of having the power of the way." I get a sense of a little bit of one-upmanship here. You know, I can go Dongshan one better. So later, when Fa Jing knew his death was near, he composed and recited a verse. This is mandatory for Zen masters, to compose a death verse. His verse was, "This year, in the first week of the fifth month, the four gross elements will leave their host." That's me. Yeah. "Let the white bones be exposed to the wind and spare finding a plot from a donor." So he's saying, just leave me out in the open. Spare the expense of an expensive burial plot. He gave away his clothing and his few belongings to his attendant to sell and give the proceeds to the monks. Then, at the sound of the bell, the night bell, he sat in zazen and died. Then his attendant said, "According to our old pact, you said to call you. So he called three times. Always has to be three. And Fa Jing replied, "What?" The attendant asked, "Why are you going naked and barefoot?" Fa Jing said, "What did I have when I came into this life?" His attendant then tried to put a robe on him. And Fa Jing said, stop, leave that for others later. The attendant protested, "What about now?" And Fa Jing said, "Still, it's just thus." And then he's saying gently, this is how it is. I'm dying. Don't turn away or busy yourself. I don't know if you've ever been at the deathbed of someone you loved and how some people have to fuss, you know, straighten things and go get things because it's so hard just to be there. So he's saying, just be here. He's taking care of his attendant. He's the one who's dying, and he's the one who's not dying is taking care a little more of his dear student. So he recites one more verse and then solemnly dies. 73 years like a lightning flash, about to go, for you I put a thread through. That means I delay my death. I'm maintaining this thread of connection a little bit longer for you. And then the iron ox leaps past Korea, smashing into emptiness, shattering it into pieces. So you have the sense that for this wise old man, his dying is an act of determined letting go. It's not easy, even for this old Zen master. It took a certain amount of determination to let go. Wansong, the commentator, says, "Dongshan knew the one who isn't ill. Fa Jing knew the one who doesn't die. Therefore, those two elders came and went freely. When the ancients were about to go, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness, and death." These old guys were playful and caring, even in their last illness, even nearing death. They were still vividly alive. And when they died, they faced their dying head on. Now, maybe that's asking a lot of our practice, to die sitting in zazen. I don't know whether we can pull that off or not. But we can practice with our lesser afflictions, you know, with our everyday afflictions and those of others. When we're fully present right here in the midst, sometimes in the midst of suffering, right in the middle of the mess of our lives, sometimes a kind of quiet joy arises, unsought, unbidden. The touch of a friendly hand, sound of a child's laughter, the sweetness of a ripe strawberry, the colors of a sunset, the beauty of a very old face. The list is endless. The possibilities are limitless. Our culture conditions us to think of happiness as a kind of flashy Disneyland, Hollywood sort of thing. So we tend not to value or even notice the small, quiet joys. Our practice is to train ourselves to pay attention to the whole range of our experience, not to get stuck. And it's particularly important, essential to do that, to open to the whole range when we are sick with illness or heartache. Zen Center teacher.
Blanche?
No. Lived for decades with rheumatoid arthritis and taught.
Darlene Cohen.
I just had a brain lapse. Darlene Cohen, wonderful teacher who dealt with incredible chronic pain, taught that we need to, particularly when we have a lot of pain, whether it's physical or emotional in our lives, we need to cultivate specific experiences of very direct experience of joy, of pleasure. Not to cling to them, but to make sure they're in our lives. Going back to Wansong's commentary once more, he says there's a proverb which says, an old doctor seldom uses divination. He says that means when a doctor is old, he becomes clear and perceptive. He can diagnose without using divination. I guess in those days, that's how, you know, how they diagnose. Use the I Ching or something. Then he says, Dongshan is like that old expert. He doesn't see that there is any sickness. The young monks trying to come near to look in on him have a hard time because when they try to face him, they are turning away from him. And that's, you know, we turn away when we try and face suffering. It's human, you know, it's natural to withdraw from suffering. And yet, our practice gives us a way to not turn away. A friend of mine who's been going through chemotherapy commented when we looked at this line together that's how he feels often with most of his friends and acquaintances, that they, you know, they say, oh, how are you doing? But they're turning away almost at the same moment. So he's making a practice when he goes for treatments and enters that maze of the medical system, the cancer system. He's making a practice of, and he says it can feel very dehumanizing. So he makes a point of using the names of the people who are, of the practitioners that he meets, and making eye contact. Even if they're not doing that with him, using his name or making eye contact, he initiates that. And it's led to some very moving shifts and openings in the patient-caregiver relationship. Wansong says, the cold pine's sick branches are even more outstanding for their sickness. We can see that in nature, can't we? We can see, you know, the beauty of the lightning-struck tree. You know, the sort of terrifying beauty of the post-flood destruction. It's harder to see when it's someone we love or ourselves. But I think my friends, my friend, this person and others I know who are ill, have that beauty. And I think that hospice volunteers or others who are companions to those who are ill or suffering come to understand this, come to see that beauty. Can we see others with generous Dharma eyes wide open, even when they're ill or hurting? When we ourselves are sick or suffering, can we attend and nurture body, heart, and mind? Can we still keep our Dharma light burning, even when we feel that we're not at the top of our game? So that we can offer our lives to others, even in our weakness. If we can, we may even experience some of those moments of quiet joy, perhaps to our own surprise, and share them. To live in this world as bodhisattvas, even baby bodhisattvas, training bodhisattvas, which we all are, whether we know it or not, we must be able, as the poet Mary Oliver says, to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. To love what is mortal, and that doesn't mean clinging. It means wide open-hearted love. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. And again, that doesn't mean clinging. It just means knowing what's already true, that our life does depend on everything else. And when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. So you didn't know that's what you were really practicing this weekend, did you? Or maybe some of you did, for sure. We're practicing letting go with a little bit of grace, a little bit more grace, maybe even a little sense of playfulness, and like those old Zen guys of long ago. With a little bit more lightness. So thank you. Thank you all for practicing together with us and inviting us here. And may our practice together continue wherever we are.
Page 4.